Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. This past Friday, Carrie hosted a roundtable about American feminism, whether it has a new purpose in today's political landscape. Today, we're going to take that conversation a step further and ask, is there a place for conservative women in the feminist movement? And is there a place for women who are against abortion? When the Women's March on Washington was in its planning stage, a pro-life group based in Texas called the New Wave Feminists was granted partnership status. But later, after a blast of criticism on social media, organizers removed the group, stating, "The Women's March platform is pro-choice, and that has been our stance from day one." Planned Parenthood and NARAL Pro-Choice America were co-sponsors of the event. As a result, many women who had felt called to participate in the march, women who want pay equity or better health care, decided to stay home, feeling their presence was not wanted. So, how can feminism be more welcoming to conservative women? Joining me this hour is Mary Fiorito, visiting fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in D.C. She joins us from Chicago. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Absolutely. We're also joined by Gina Messina, Assistant Professor of Religion and Gender Studies at Ursuline College in Ohio. She's the co-founder of Feminism and Religion, and she's the author of the forthcoming book, If Jesus Ran for President. Gina, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
First to you, Mary, how do you define feminism?
Well, you know, I guess I would take sort of the classical definition of feminism, the one that, you know, you'll almost always find in a dictionary, which is basically the principle that women and men are equal and deserve equal opportunity in economic spheres, in political spheres, and in social equality. So that, you know, there is not a separate set of standards by which women and men are judged in the workplace, in businesses, and in access to opportunity.
Great. Gina, what does feminism mean to you?
Sure. I actually have a real problem with the word equality because I don't think it really offers what the feminist movement is looking for. And so I often like to talk about the idea of, you know, honoring full humanity and thinking about what it means to liberate one from oppression. And so certainly feminism is focused on liberating women from sexism. But it's also about ending oppression wherever it exists, because you cannot really uproot one oppression without uprooting them all. So to me, feminism is focused on uprooting oppressions for all persons so that we can achieve social justice, you know, within our society.
Mm. We're talking this hour about feminism and what role conservative women have in it. If you didn't feel welcome at last month's women's marches, why not? What would it take for you to feel welcome in the feminist movement? We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. And online at nprnews.org/live. Mary, what do you think was lost by not including those who are against abortion in the Women's March?
Oh, my goodness, so much was lost. You know, what an opportunity, first of all, for women of all backgrounds, all political persuasions, all religious affiliations, who really would have had a lot to say, you know, as a group together. And by specifically excluding women who don't believe that abortion frees women from the Women's March, I just think we really, first of all, I thought it made overall, you know, the march itself look a little bit petty, you know, that certain women's groups were being excluded because of viewpoints, strongly held viewpoints, but they were being excluded because of viewpoints. So it wasn't as inclusive as it had set out to be. And I think a lot, unfortunately, of the attention that was then drawn to the Women's March, which started out in, you know, in a very wonderfully inclusive and enthusiastic way, a lot of that message got lost because of this sort of very public infighting among who could really be considered a feminist, you know, the sort of who's in and who's out of the feminist movement. And I think that, unfortunately, at the end of the day, took away from what could have been a very powerful and cohesive message.
Gina, what's your take on it?
Well, you know, first of all, I think that, you know, feminism is definitely about inclusion. But when talking about reproductive justice, this is a very, very serious issue that feminism is focused on. And so, you know, I don't really like to talk about the word abortion because I think the issue is so much bigger than that. And, you know, feminism is focused on, you know, the rights of women. Amongst, you know, the rights of those who are marginalized. And when we're talking about reproductive justice, there are so many different issues that come into play here. And this is a major, major component of what this march was about and the rights that are being threatened for women today. So I don't think anybody should be excluded. And certainly people had the opportunity to march if they wanted to. But the march itself was not going to be on a platform and saying that we are including, you know, ideas that are pro-life, because frankly, I think the word pro-life is really problematic. I think it's more about being pro-birth than pro-life. And so I think a larger conversation needs to happen, you know, around these issues. And so it makes sense to me that, you know, this was not included in the march itself.
Just to push back against that a little bit, when you say that this is about people who are marginalized, and there is a large subset of the population that says, look, your unborn daughter is, you know, is one of the most vulnerable beings out there, and how can you not step up to that? So, I mean, do you recognize that there's just a difference of opinion there in terms of when you're talking about marginalized, where there's a people who feel very strongly that they are representing those who are marginalized when they say that they are against abortion?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we all have differences of opinion, right? And we're all entitled to our opinions. But when it comes down to the issue, I think that we're very, very focused on the idea of protecting a fetus, and we miss what a larger conversation on pro-life means. So those who are really focused on the issue of abortion, my question is, why are you not focused on issues around refugees being banned from our nation? Why are you not focused on the death penalty? Or why are you not, you know, focused on torture, which has been becoming a major part of the conversation now? So
is it a matter of either or? I mean, aren't there who are both?
Well, if you look at, you know, if I could just jump in here,
yeah,
if you
go ahead, Mary.
At the nation's probably the largest organized opponent of abortion, the Catholic Church, is also simultaneously the single largest provider of social services to men, women, children, and families in the United States, because we have what we call a consistent life ethic approach, which means that all human life, from the moment of conception till the moment of natural death, is sacred and is worthy of our protection and worthy of our defense. Now, it doesn't mean that every single person who is working, for example, to end legal abortion needs to simultaneously be working to help refugees, nor are the people who are helping refugees expected, for example, to be working at a pregnancy resource clinic, because everybody's called to use their gifts, you know, in a different way. But cohesively, as a church, you look at the Catholic Church just as an example, they are doing so much to bring an end to human suffering in all sorts of different ways. And just to go back sort of to an earlier point about, you know, unborn women in the womb, I mean, to me, like, the great irony is that the vast majority of sex selection abortions that are done in our world are done in baby girls for no other reason than the fact that they're baby girls. And you know, if we're going to be talking about inequality and, you know, a lack of justice for women, why is it that female babies are singled out for this in countries like China? And it's legal here in the United States. We don't know how often it's practiced, but it's absolutely legal if you want to do it. And there are many women who love their unborn daughters and their born daughters just as much as I love their sons, and want that kind of respect for them, both in the law and in greater society.
We're talking this hour about feminism and the role for conservative women or women who have differing views in the major platform. And is there a place for them in the feminist movement? And we're also taking your calls. You can join us at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to the phones. We've got Hallie on the line from St. Paul. Hallie, good morning. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
So I consider myself a pro-life feminist, and I was definitely really excited about the Women's March. And but I won't lie, I right away kind of wondered and questioned if it was going to become a pro-choice movement, and it sure did. And so I did feel, I was one of those that felt pretty excluded from it, and I was sad to not be able to participate with my two young daughters. I'm very concerned about the present administration and our nation's leadership, but I did feel excluded because I feel actually that, you know, to call something a women's march and be extremely broad, to include an entire 50% of our population in that title, but then to say, you know, you have to be pro-choice to be part of this, or that you have to support the pro-choice leadership of this movement and sponsorship by NARAL and Planned Parenthood. That was just really disheartening to me. I actually feel abortion is quite oppressive to women. I feel it allows a certain freedom to a sexual partner to, you know, essentially, you know, have no consequences of a sexual act, and then the woman is left to deal with that. And I know many women would say, well, of course, the woman can use abortion too. It gives her freedom too. But I actually see it differently. I see it as, you know, one of the most amazing things that makes women women is that we have this power to give life and this power to nourish life. And denying that or you know, suppressing that with something violent that I see abortion as being is really problematic. And so the earlier comment by one of your guests that said, you know, this is about reproductive justice and it's about the rights of women, I just really find that ironic because there is no justice in killing another human being, and there, especially somebody who never has a chance to say anything about it, right, and who is innocent. But then also just that, you know, do the rights of women really need to rest on the right to end another life? And can we achieve justice by truly honoring a woman's power, her sexual power, certainly, and her fertile power, and say, you know, the argument about being pro-birth versus pro-life, I totally acknowledge that. There are some groups in the pro-life movement that are more pro-birth than pro-life, but I've personally been involved quite a bit in the pro-life movement since high school, and I'm 34 now, and I would say that the younger generation would be very heartening to your guest speaker in that the younger generation of the pro-life movement is really, really focusing on not only supporting that woman to give birth to the child, but supporting her in her options for what next. You know, if she'd like to place the baby for adoption, we have ways to support you doing that. Mm-hmm. If you decide you want to keep it, we can connect you. For example, crisis pregnancy centers here in the Twin Cities, you're going to see a lot of movement in here in the Twin Cities toward, you know, let's get you connected to food support. Let's get you connected to diaper support. Let's get you connected to early childhood learning.
Hallie, thank you so much for sharing your views on this, and I really appreciate it. But I also want to give Gina Messina an opportunity to respond to what you said. You brought up several really good points. Gina, what do you think?
Yes.
What Hallie's take on this?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I want to be very clear that abortion is not murder. It's not killing a life. We're talking about a fetus that is unviable outside of the womb. And we need to, you know, of course, the major part of the conversation is when does life begin? Does it begin at conception? Does it begin when the fetus is, you know, able to exist outside the womb? And that is a major part of the conversation. So
Gina,
what
I want to say is I think we could end up spending the rest of the hour just debating abortion. And I don't think we want to do that. I think what we want to say is you have people who feel strongly about the issue. How do we move past this line in the sand that's been drawn that people say, if you're on this side, you're sorry, you're not welcome. If you're on this side, you're in. How is there a way to make room for people that have those differing views about abortion in the feminist movement?
Well, you know, where I like to start is I like to go back to we would call the first wave feminists. So the viewpoints of women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and Alice Paul, who wrote the first Equal Rights Amendment, who all were very much opposed to abortion. In Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton's newspaper, The Revolution, they refused to run ads for abortion services, which of course were available even back then. They saw abortion as a way that women were oppressed by men, and they saw the rights of pregnant women in particular as being very much threatened by abortion as a way by which men used women, and they saw the rights of the unborn child as being really much, very much bound up with the rights of their mother. And so it's when I go back and I look at some of the things that they wrote, the example that they gave to women, they saw women's equality as really a world where both women and the gift that their fertility was. They didn't see women's fertility, our ability to bring new life into the world, as a burden or as a problem, but as a gift, a special gift that only women could bring. And so therefore, they wanted to protect that. And so that was a tremendous influence for me when I was sort of young and in my 20s and in law school, about how much that really inspired my involvement as a very young lawyer in the pro-life movement, because I was so struck by their example. And it's unfortunate that this sort of, you know, second or third wave feminism has, first of all, gotten so far away from, you know, the roots of the founding feminists, but also has become so far away from those roots that anyone who, you know, has a difference of opinion on this is automatically excluded and automatically can't be part of the club. And, you know, it's kind of funny because the original feminists all said, you know, when we, I think it was Elizabeth Cady Stanton who said this, you know, when we as women consider that we have been treated as property, it is unjust that we would then look at unborn children as property to be disposed of as we see fit. So having suffered themselves from that, from being, you know, treated as not fully human, they saw turning around and referring to unborn children in a dehumanizing way as very much against founding feminist principles.
Gina Messina, so going back to that conversation, I'd love to hear more from you about how is it you can welcome people in, even with if they have strongly different viewpoints?
Right, absolutely. Well, first, I want to comment on Mary's comments about first wave feminism, because I certainly, you know, am grateful for first wave feminism and the women who've paved the way for, you know, feminism to grow and evolve over time. But we also have to acknowledge that we are in the 21st century today, and there's other factors involved and other, you know, we have different knowledge and different information than we would have had during first wave feminism movement. And so, you know, we have to acknowledge that. We have to acknowledge that we're in a very, very different place. And when we're talking about abortion, I think we need to move away from that topic, and we need to talk about reproductive justice, number one. It is a much larger issue. When I feel like the pro-life movement tends to focus on a very white understanding of abortion. We're thinking about privileged women who are just choosing to have an abortion because they don't want to deal with consequences. And this is a ridiculous idea. We need to take into consideration the idea of intersectionality, of social class, of you know, the different populations that are marginalized within society, economic justice. There is much that comes into play here. And so we're unwilling to focus on that because we want to simplify the issue and say it is just this one thing. And so while I don't think anybody should be excluded from anything, but if you're coming into the feminist movement with the point of saying, I want to limit a person, a woman's decision on her own reproductive rights, that is highly, highly problematic.
Right,
in addition to that, we have to think about the fact that when we're thinking about how our laws are developed in this nation, we are developing laws about women's bodies primarily with male perspectives. And that is also highly problematic.
And I just to clarify again, Gina, I don't think we're going to solve the debate around abortion and how it works today. But it's more about saying how do we allow somebody to participate on other issues that they feel are important, even if they disagree with you on abortion? They agree, but maybe they are interested in pay equity. Maybe they're interested in better health care or paid maternity leave. How do you make space for them, even if you disagree on this other very obviously charged issue?
You know,
right,
that's
and
very
I think that people should absolutely have the opportunity to participate in these issues, you know, if they feel strongly about pay equity, if they feel strongly about, you know, women's health access or parental leave. Absolutely, absolutely they should have the right to participate in those movements.
And are they welcome but in the feminist movement?
I think they're welcome in certain sections of the feminist movement, because I think that a voice that speaks out against a woman's right to choose within the feminist movement is counteractive to what the feminist movement stands for.
Let's go back
and
to the,
I want to
okay.
say also,
you know, I want to get back to the callers. We have a lot of callers on the line. So let's go to PJ from Minneapolis. PJ, I want to bring you into the conversation here. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks very much.
Yeah.
I am really delighted by this conversation. I think it's so important because as a pro-life person, I do feel like I'm never quite sure what role I have, because abortion or reproductive justice or whatever circulates around that topic is such a pressure point. And I feel like we're doing a disservice to what advances we can make for women generally by letting that thing be the main thing. And I'm afraid that it divides us. And this is a time, especially with our current president and some of the ways that he's characterized women in particular, that we should really be coming together around this, the most elemental things, like Mary was citing before, just about pay justice, about equality in the workplace, about so many other things. And I just feel like it's a golden opportunity for us to be drawn together and to not allow this thing to divide us. And so we do have to work towards finding ways to converse about that, because I realize that that is that's a big piece of some people who identify themselves as feminists. I don't subscribe to that, and so I still find myself to be a feminist, although not by everyone's definition. So mm-hmm. all I want to say is, to the extent that we can come around the all so many other issues and not let that divide us, I think we'll be stronger because of it.
All right, PJ, thanks for that. Mary, do you want to build on that?
Yeah, you know, PJ, which is an excellent point, when Pew Research interviewed, you know, American women in 2016 and as a precursor to the election about the issues that were most important to them, abortion didn't make the top 10. It didn't make the top 10. I mean, remember, this was a few years ago, I think mm-hmm. it was in Glamour magazine, that, you know, the issues most important to women, abortion didn't make the top 10. The issues that are most critical to women, equal pay issues, child care issues in particular, for women to be able to work in, you know, jobs other than household positions and be able to afford, you know, affordable child care is a huge issue for women. Equal opportunities for advancement is a huge issue. But abortion doesn't make the top 10. And so when we take, you know, an issue that is really pretty far down the line for where most American women, you know, are struggling in their day-to-day lives, and we sort of make it the most important thing, and then we tell women who disagree about the fact that this is not the most important thing, that they're not even welcome to be part of a larger movement or a larger conversation, I think it sets all of us as women back. Again, you know, I was so pained by some of this public infighting when New Wave feminists were told that they could not partner with the march any longer. You know, there's that old stereotype. But I remember being in a class in law school one time, in fact, when a classmate and I were in sort of a heated discussion about, I can't even remember the topic now, and my professor actually sort of made a snide sort of side remark about, you know, girls catfighting. And there's still that stereotype that exists about women when they disagree on things, that it's a catfight, that we can't get along. And I thought, unfortunately, that this very public disagreement about not allowing pro-life women to participate as partners in the Women's March sort of underscored that horrible stereotype. And it makes all women suffer because then, you know, who's taking us seriously if we can't even say we will put aside differences on some issues? I mean, and I can't imagine that at that Women's March there weren't other women who disagreed on particular, you know, foundational aspects of the march itself, but they wanted to be there and they wanted to be included over a uniting principle. And it seems that the uniting principle somehow got lost.
Mm-hmm. Gina, what do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting. And I think that Mary makes some good points about this idea of women being, catfighting and whatnot. And I do want to say that I don't feel that women who identify themselves as being pro-life could not come and participate in the march. I mean, they absolutely could have. They absolutely could have made that choice to come and march for issues around pay equity, to march around issues related to parental leave and so on. But there was also a decision by those persons to not march because they felt, there was a stronger focus on this aspect of reproductive justice and feeling excluded. I'm sorry. So while March itself may have said, we're not going to partner and bring this particular organization on as a partner in this march, it doesn't mean that people weren't free to choose to participate and both voice their concerns about these other issues. Reproductive justice is where I think the conversation needs to begin. I think that eliminates the line between pro-choice versus pro-life. And I think that that's where we need to have the conversation. Mm-hmm. I agree that every person, you know, has a right to march and to participate and to come together over these issues that are really, really critical for women's rights. But we need to stop arguing over this issue of abortion and start looking at what the larger picture is and taking into account that it is not a simplified issue. There is much more to it. And let's look at the larger picture and work together. I agree with that. I absolutely do agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah, although, Gina, you know, unfortunately, pro-life women who did sort of take your spirit of showing up anyway, some of them had their signs torn up. Abby Johnson, who's a very prominent woman in the pro-life movement, she's a former Planned Parenthood clinic operator, was their former employee of the year, who is now very active in the pro-life movement. I think she's 6 months pregnant with twins. She's visibly pregnant, and she was actually knocked to the curb. And to the credit of other women who were marching, they kind of came to her rescue and kept her from being further victimized by some of the march participants. But the pro-life women I'm aware of who went were very much told that they were not welcome to be there. And so unfortunately, that got quite a bit of media press and coverage as well, which I think just overall hurts us as a movement of women trying to garner more respect and more understanding
right.
of what we as women can bring to the greater community, you know. So I think, unfortunately, in an ideal world, every pro-life woman could have felt like they could have gone in March, but that's unfortunately not what happened that day.
We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. If you're joining us, we're talking about the role for women, the conservative women in the feminist movement. How can the feminist movement be more welcoming to women of different viewpoints? You can call us with your question or comment, your ideas, 651-227-6000 or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. Do you call yourself a feminist? Why or why not? You can also reach us online at nprnews.org/live. We'll get back to this conversation and to our guests and your calls in just a moment. But first, it's time for an update with news headlines with Phil Picardi. Good morning, Phil.
Hi, Marianne. Opponents of the Dakota Access Pipeline are calling for protests around the world as the Army prepares to greenlight construction of the final stage of the project. The Army yesterday said it will allow the pipeline to cross under a Missouri River reservoir in North Dakota, clearing the way for completion of the $3.8 billion project to move oil from North Dakota to Illinois. Standing Rock Sioux tribal members say a pipeline leak could contaminate their drinking water. The project developer says the pipeline is safe. President Trump is asserting his right to enact an immigration travel ban. This morning, he told a group of police chiefs his order was done for the security of the U.S. A federal judge has put the ban on hold, and an appeals court is considering an appeal from the Trump administration. Democrats are accusing Senate Republicans of muzzling Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's been barred from saying anything more about Republican Senator Jeff Sessions, the nominee to be Attorney General. Warren was given the rare penalty last night for imputing a fellow senator. On the Senate floor, Warren read aloud from a 1986 letter from the Martin Luther King widow, in which she wrote Sessions as a prosecutor in Alabama worked to discourage blacks from voting. A vote on Sessions is expected this evening. And President Trump is expected to have lunch tomorrow with a group of moderate Senate Democrats who could play a key role in his legislative agenda. The lunch is expected to include Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, and John Tester of Montana. Trump faces a narrow Republican majority in the Senate, and he hopes to secure some support among Democrats. All four face re-election in 2018. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:38.
Every Wednesday on All Things Considered, get a taste of regional food and drink trends, reviews, recipes, and advice. Our stable of food experts serve it up on Appetites. I'm Tom Cran. What's news and what's for dinner? Join me starting at 3.
Stay tuned. Coming up at 10, it's 1A. Today we're talking about dystopian writers. Host Joshua Johnson talks about dealing with dystopia and why certain writers are enjoying a surge in popularity at the start of the year. George Orwell, Aldous Huxley, Margaret Atwood, their books are flying off the shelves as millions reach for fictional accounts of tyrants, new world orders, and darker historical landscapes. That's coming up on 1A at 10 o'clock.
Programming supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities, and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs. And this hour, we're talking about the intersection of conservatism and feminism. Is there a place for conservative women in the feminist movement? My guests this hour are Mary Fiorito. She's the visiting fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in D.C. And Gina Messina. She's the assistant professor of religion and gender studies at Ursuline College in Ohio. Let's get back to the calls. We've got Alyssa on the line from Redwood Falls. Alyssa, welcome to the conversation.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for waiting.
Yeah. Wow. What a great and really heated conversation.
Glad you're enjoying it.
I think my comment lies in my experience. So I was born and raised in rural Wisconsin in a very conservative, Republican, don't question, very pro-life. So that's what I was raised in birth to 18, and then came to the Twin Cities for university, which is a very different environment, and have kind of forged my own what I would call moderate, libertarian, liberal viewpoint. And now, as a single working mother and a first-generation college graduate, I made the choice to take my 5-year-old, who is not fully white, she's multi-ethnic, and I thought it was far more important for my daughter and I to participate in the march than to have to agree with what they stood on 100%.
What did you hope your daughter would get out of being in the march? Why did you think it was important for her to attend?
You know, so my values are influenced by my faith and the world around me and a hope for a better tomorrow. I have to believe that the arc of history of all the world and is bending towards justice, even though it doesn't always feel that way. And so for me, it felt more important to take my child and let her see that thousands of people across the world, as well as her and her mom, could participate in something bigger, and that the hope that kindness will win and love will win and equity will win, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but it will. And she saw that. So I would, if I had to put myself in a box, I would call myself a pro-choice anti-abortion voter. So I don't ever promote abortion, but I will never, ever vote in a way that would restrict a woman's right to choose. So as a single woman, I chose to carry to term and raise my child. And yet I would never, ever think that a government on any level should tell a woman how to choose.
Alyssa,
so that's why I vote
yeah,
that way.
Yeah. Alyssa, but thank you so much for your call. I think that right there is a really important distinction to make. And Gina, I want to get your take on this. For welcoming women into the fold, that she's talking about just her own choice versus legislating against others. That seems like somebody should be fits right in with along with the feminist movement there.
I really love what Alyssa said here, and I think what she had some really critical points, and it makes me think about Joe Biden and his debate during the 2012 presidential race, when he said, you know, I'm Catholic and I don't believe in abortion, but you know, those are my feelings, and it's not my right to impose that on anybody else. And I think that we forget that we are a secular nation and that people have the right to make their own decisions. So I think that's a critical piece of the conversation. And so like Alyssa, I would never choose to have an abortion. You know, I'm a woman who had a long infertility struggle and I'm an adoptive mother. But my feelings and my decisions should not be imposed on anybody else. But if I could, I just wanted to go back and comment on what Mary said about women who chose to participate in the march and had their signs ripped up. And I think it goes back to exactly the point that we were discussing. First of all, I don't condone any kind of violence ever. And it's awful that if any of these women were pushed down or had their signs ripped up, that is absolutely terrible, problematic, should not happen. But at the same time, these women came to the to this march to protest for women's, pay equity and, parental leave and all of these other issues. Then my question is, why disrupt the march by trying to make their point about their positions on reproductive issues and bring those kinds of signs?
Isn't that sort of the perfect opportunity to reach out to an audience and to push back about ideas? I mean, I remember seeing the sign that one woman was holding at the march saying, remember, 53% of white women voted for Trump at that march. Mm-hmm. And her sign was not ripped up. But this is also somebody who is pushing back against the sort of this, you know, look at us, aren't we great? We stand for women's rights, and saying, remember, you know, white women voted for Trump in the majority.
Well, and right, that the pro-life women who were marching, for example, against sex selection abortions, right? So against women being aborted for no other reason other than the fact that they were baby girls, so they just happened to be the wrong gender, and that is still very much a reality in our world today. I have the great privilege of serving on the board of directors of two maternity homes here in Chicago, where almost every one of our clients, the women and their children who live with us, and they can live with us as long as they need to. So this is not a pro-birth organization. This is an organization that helps women not only carry their children to term, but then we care for them and help our clients get job training and education so that they can be fully independent once they leave us. But one of the women who is living with us fled a country where she would have been forced to have an abortion, and she was carrying a baby girl. And she came here with nothing, and she came here by herself. And, you know, I'm so proud that we, as women and moms who are taking care of these other moms, are able to assist her. So I think women who were going to, you know, the women's march to say, listen, this is still a real issue in this world and in this country. And if you don't think it's not happening in the United States, you're not looking hard enough at some of our abortion statistics. You know, we are one of the few countries in the world that still allows abortion for all 9 months and for any reason legally. And I think, too, as women, we also need to be speaking out against things like Dr. Kermit Gosnell's case. For those of your listeners who might not be familiar, he was an abortion provider in Pittsburgh who was, you know, who killed three women in his clinic and who was regularly delivering live babies.
I think we need to get away from that because
that is a women's issue, and women were protesting that kind of violence and you know, discrimination against women at that march, and their voices should have been welcomed. And to exclude them simply because of their pro-life viewpoints, again, it cut out tens of thousands of women from that march who would have otherwise joined it.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Bethany on the line from Minneapolis. Bethany, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thanks for having me on the conversation.
Thanks for calling.
I'm actually one of the lead organizers for the Minnesota Women's March.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to share, I feel, an important viewpoint that's not being represented on this call currently, or this show, is that Minnesota very, very vocally made it clear that everyone was welcome at our march. So I can see how nationally that message came down, that pro-life women were not invited. I can understand 100%. But if you look at the facts, we did an interview with Carrie Levin saying, we absolutely want you there. If you believe women's rights are human rights, if you believe in equity and equality, then you need to be at this march. And 100%, everyone may not agree with everything that's being said. Okay, so there were 8 core values within that, very progressive core values. However, if you believed in any of those core values, now is the time to come together. We're divided enough. There needs to be an intersectionality, not between, not just between genders and diversity and all that, but in this pro-life, pro-choice group, to continue to only focus on the things that divide us is not what is going to push the needle for women's rights, mm-hmm. for human rights, and for equity.
Well, then, Bethany, help us to move forward here. So how would you move forward and say, let's build this intersectionality and let's leave these hot topic issues behind and build some sense of sisterhood or movement moving forward? How does that happen?
Well, number one, it happens by having difficult conversations. As someone who was in a leadership role for this, I can't tell you how many emails and phone calls and sit-downs I had with people who said, like, I don't agree with this message, or I don't agree with this point, or you're missing this. And until we're willing to sit down and actually have those conversations and hear one another's viewpoint, we can't find that intersectionality. So first of all, there needs to be communication, right? I hear women calling in saying that at the local march, they weren't invited, and that's not true. And I haven't been reached out to by them. I can tell you that other organizers of the march weren't reached out. So let's have a conversation around that. Second, let's find what that intersectionality point is. So we don't agree on this. What do we agree on? Do you agree that we need to close the pay gap? Do you agree that we need to be proactive in reaching for rights of immigrants or rights of those with disabilities? There's 7 other things on that list that we can come together on and work together on, without focusing on the one that may divide us.
Mm. Bethany, thank you so much for calling in. Mary, Gina, can you take that and run with it? Can you build off of what Bethany's saying there?
Oh, I'm so grateful that the local march in Minnesota was so inclusive, and that they did take the time to have those hard conversations, right? Because as just this conversation we've been having this morning shows, it can be a very incendiary issue, but there are so many other issues that we as women really can unite on. Like, you know, as I mentioned, that Pew Research study, how about we just focus on the top 10 concerns that women have raised and try to work together to address those and put aside our differences? That's something I'm always very grateful at the March for Life we have been able to do. I mean, there's the, pro-life atheists. Nat Hentoff was of the Village Voice, was probably the most prominent member of that. Pro-life secular humanists. There's very religious groups. There's a Pro-Life Alliance of Gays and Lesbians. But we all unite under that day, under that particular banner that all life is sacred from the moment of conception until the moment of death. And so on that day, we put everything else aside. And I'm grateful that in Minnesota, that the women there were able to do that. But it takes listening, and it takes patience, and it takes, putting aside egos sometimes to be able to listen well to others.
Gina, what about you?
Yeah, well, I really agree with Bethany had to say, and with a lot of what Mary had to say as well. I mean, I think it is important that we consider what we agree on and how we can work together to, create positive change in our society. But we also cannot ignore a critical part of the feminist conversation and the feminist movement that is focused on reproductive justice. So I think that everybody should be included, and we should focus on the issues that we can come together on. But I also don't think that we can say, well, we're just not going to talk about this issue at all, because it is a very important part of the feminist movement.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Emily on the line from Minneapolis. Emily, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure thing.
I identify as feminist, but also as pro-life. And so I think a lot of times I feel politically homeless because of that. My comment is, I think when we, as a society, as we talk about women's rights and women's issues, if we allow that to immediately refer to sexual rights and reproductive rights, I think that that sort of inadvertently can reinforce an archaic stereotype that feminine identity is primarily a sexual identity, when, as Mary pointed out, there are so many other issues that are immediately affecting women in their day-to-day lives. Of course, reproductive health and sexual rights are so important, but I have trouble with that when it's addressed in the media. When we talk about women's rights, that immediately means we're talking about sexual or reproductive rights.
Emily, great point. So, Gina and Mary, for those women who are for whatever reason are not having children and say they're past the childbearing age, there's a lot on the feminist platform that doesn't necessarily apply to them. How do you make the feminist movement speak to all women, not just those of childbearing age who are looking for, childcare or paid maternity leave?
Well, I think that the conversation does apply to all women, and that these issues do apply to all women. Just because you're not of a childbearing age doesn't mean that you shouldn't be invested of the rights of women in general, right? And seeing how, our society can evolve over time and really honor the human rights of women. So I think that the issues do impact every person, regardless of where we are in our own individual lives, because it's not about one person, it's about the larger group. So I think that that's really critical to understand, first of all. And second of all, yes, there are so many issues that are involved in the feminist movement. It isn't just about reproductive justice. And I don't think that it is always focused on just reproductive justice when we have these conversations in the media. I mean, we know that there are serious issues revolving around women's pay, around issues related to various issues on health care, and so on and so forth. So I think that, we know the conversation is larger, but all of these pieces are important for women as a whole. And
Mary?
That we have to acknowledge.
I guess I would go back to what was sort of the point at which women decided to have this march. What was the motivating force behind it? And it was an incredibly vulgar comment that President Trump made, and that so struck at the heart of women's dignity and as of who we are. And it's such a crass, vulgar term. And that's what was the flashpoint, if you will, right? That's what everybody said, listen, we need to do something. We cannot have men and men in power speaking of women in these derogatory, vulgar terms. And I have three daughters, and I can't tell you, my skin crawls every time I hear that P word, because it is, I just think there's very few words that you can use to refer to a woman that so attack our dignity and go to the core of our being, right? So, I mean, for me, it is something, and I understand why that was such an upsetting and motivating force for so many women and why this march came together the way that it did. So for women who are of non-reproductive ages, that certainly would be a rallying call for them as well, right? Because no woman ever wants to be called by a term like that. But what was upsetting for me is that is the taking of that term and then almost sort of glorifying it in some of these women's marches, right? From the pea hats that were knitted to the sign after sign after sign that you saw at some of these marches that kept repeating that word over and over again. And just to me, as a mom of girls, I didn't want them to be exposed to that. So while the thought of attempting to go to the march for us, even as pro-life women, as a group of pro-life women family, was tempting to us, I decided instead to take my two teenage daughters. I didn't take my younger daughter, but my teenage daughters, and I went to see Hidden Figures instead.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to do something to mark that day, but I wanted to do it in a way that would show them how to maintain your dignity as a woman when it's being attacked. And, of course, these women had dual, you know, issues to deal with. You know, not only were they being mistreated because they were women, but also because they were women of color. And I wanted them to see the way a dignified, refined woman responds.
All right.
I wanted them to be able to, you know, witness other women who, faced with that kind of adversity, were able to rise above it and were able to maintain personal dignity as they did so. So that was the way we, you know, we kind of marched over to the movie theater instead of marching to downtown Chicago. But and we had a great conversation afterwards, my girls and I, about why mom didn't feel it was right to go to this other march and why, you know, my youngest child was born prematurely. So my daughters and I spent a lot of time in the neonatal intensive care unit with babies as young as 22 and 23 weeks. So
Mary, we just have 1 minute left here and I need to wrap up this conversation.
It's a very personal thing. So.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering what's next. I think, you know, we have a next step here in terms of how do we continue to keep the conversation going. Gina?
I think that, you know, of course we need to keep, you know, continue to have dialogue. We need to continue to have conversation and acknowledge the points where we have, where we agree and want to work together, but we also have to acknowledge, you know, what the feminist movement's goals are. And some pieces you may not agree with, and that's okay, but I don't think that that means you should be working against those simultaneously. But I know you only have a minute left, but I just need to say this real quickly.
30 seconds.
I think that, first of all, it wasn't just about the language that Donald Trump used. It was about the fact that he has sexually assaulted women. Mm-hmm. He has a history of this. It's a much bigger issue. And also the P word.
We don't have time to get into that, unfortunately, Gina. We don't have enough time for that. But thank you both so much for both of your participation in this conversation. It has been a very charged conversation, but you've navigated it elegantly. So thanks for that. We've been talking with Mary Fiorito, visiting fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and Gina Messina, Assistant Professor of Religion and Gender Studies at Ursuline College in Ohio. You're listening to NPR News.